Succession number 21095, reel 26.
Hello, Pick, reel 26. You were saying earlier, particularly with the sort of situating the SS-20s and the Pershing and cruise missiles, about the opposition movements in Germany that occurred. Mm-hmm. And you briefly mentioned Greenham Common in this country. Did you, were you involved in any way with the protest movement?
No, I never had anything to do. I never covered domestic politics, ever, for The Guardian. And I had nothing to do with coverage of Greenham Common. Our defence correspondent, the one I mentioned, he wrote quite a lot about it, I think, but lots of people in The Guardian wrote about it, but I really didn't. But I did write quite a lot about the German protest movements, because I used to go to Germany quite a bit during all this, during that whole time, for various meetings, including summits and so on. And I always wrote about the protest movements there, and watched it, and went to some of their rallies and that kind of thing. But that always struck me as much more momentous than Greenham Common, but that's being unfair, because after all, Greenham Common was a very well intended and very well meant protest. But I don't think it's ever involved issues that were quite as serious as the German issues were, because Germany, after all, was still a fairly tender plant, and Germany was really about a possible Third World War. I mean, that is where it would occur, and a lot of people really were very frightened that instability in Germany could trigger all kinds of political and military developments that could really undo all the progress that had been achieved in terms of rebuilding Germany and East-West relations, and to what extent one could claim to have achieved détente. So Germany, to me, always seemed more important than Greenham, but I'm being very unfair, and probably anyone who actually was at Greenham and spent all those months and years living in tents and under terrible conditions, they wouldn't appreciate it very much for me to be saying, well, they were not half as interesting or as important as the German resistance was, but to me, the German one was the more significant of the two. But it was still a bit of a throwback to the upheavals of 1968. That sort of spirit of protest was still very much in the air, and young people were very much felt directly, personally touched by the deployment of those missiles in Germany. And I keep on contrasting those kind of protest movements to the kind of protest movements that we witness today, where you have almost professional armies of protesters who will zoom in on any issue that presents itself in a wholly, often wholly illogical way, and with very, very misplaced values. Since this is at the moment very much in the forefront, where do you rate animals as against humans? And all the various protest movements against animal experiments, for example, I find totally irresponsible, and things where I really feel that a much more determined stand should be taken. And I was felt much more sympathetic towards the people who were prepared to march, or indeed, I mean, to be at Greenham in protest against nuclear weapons, where you know, that made real sense in terms of people's health and people's lives and military threats and all the rest of it. But to be defending animals when you could in fact do so much good to help human beings with medicines and so on, is to my mind absolutely crazy. And again, the protest movements against international trade agreements, you just feel people protesting for the sake of protesting, and they will take up any cause that they want. But that was different in those days. In those days, the people who were marching, the people who were protesting, who was standing at the gates of SS-20 deployments or whatever, and they had real reason to be protesting. You may not agree with them, but at least these were specifics that affected human beings. And where you could you could understand what they were protesting about, and where they had arguments that were credible. But now there are few arguments; there are just assertions and threats. So I'm sorry, I've digressed again, but. It's just that I think it's useful to put some perspective on the kind of protest movements that we saw in the late 60s and the 70s and into the 80s, which were related to real live issues of survival, and the kind of high fashion for protest for the sake of protest which we seem to be having now. I mean, it's a sort of anarchy without any kind of, without a cause to pursue.
I know you've given the sort of main reasons for the sort of fragmentation of the Soviet Empire, but do you think these protest movements, you know, particularly the one in Germany, did that play any part, do you think?
In the breakup of the Soviet Union, no, I don't think so. I think the only part it played is that it did, I think, make governments more aware of the need to negotiate on arms control issues. And to some extent, I suppose, it made the Soviet leadership more aware of the need to take concrete steps to convince, to persuade the West that it wanted peaceful coexistence, that it was not, that it did not pose a threat. But of course, the protest movements, to some extent, played into the hands of the Soviet Union, because they thought they sort of had a ready-made fifth column in the West that supported their contention that they were no threat, and that it was the West that was the aggressor. That the West was threatening the Soviet Union with its missile deployments, not the other way around. But I think that, of course, is how Western governments perceived the protest movements, that you know they were, in a sense, traitors to the cause. But I think in the end, it forced both sides to take a second look at what they were doing, and I think particularly the Americans began to realize that these were situations they had to deal with if the Western alliance, if NATO was going to survive, because you know I think at that point with the Germans sort of almost you know with Germany almost in open revolt, with the Dutch also being very vocal in their disagreement over the deployment or over the need to deploy the missile, the medium-range missiles, the Americans did begin to feel that their interests in Europe were threatened. And of course, in those days, they still saw Europe as a major interest, as an essential interest, as a vital interest that they had to secure. So I think for all those reasons, the protest movements in Europe did play a considerable part. And you know, I don't want to underestimate the importance of Greenham in all of this. I mean, Greenham was part of all of this. It's just that because of the German geography, Germany did seem to be a much more crucial area of where a much more crucial area to the whole assessment of what the protest movements meant and how seriously they had to be taken. But I think that overall, without the protest movements, the negotiations on medium-range missiles would have proceeded at an even slower pace than they really did. And that includes the fact that the talks were actually suspended for a time because of that. I should, before we lose nuclear weapons altogether, just also refer to short-range nuclear missiles, which, although never as important as the controversy and the debates over the medium-range nuclear missiles, did also play quite a significant, did occupy quite a significant place in the whole equation on nuclear arms. And I think there's a sort of tiny little footnote to what I've been saying. I remember one day lunching with one of Mrs. Thatcher's very close advisors here in London, and in the process of that lunch being told, seemingly quite casually, that Mrs. Thatcher, who was Prime Minister at the time, had decided that British short-range nuclear, that Britain no longer saw any need for short-range nuclear weapons in Europe. And we led the paper with that story the next day, and it was quite obvious afterwards that this had been a deliberate leak. And, you know, that I happened to have been the beneficiary of that, but that was quite an important signal, both to the Russians and, of course, also to the Americans. And I would have to look up what the date of that was, but it was certainly after Gorbachev had assumed power in Moscow.
Having sort of spoken about these various negotiations and, you know, the agreements, what are your thoughts on George W. Bush and the idea that Star Wars might start up again, you know, the ABM treaty might be abolished?
Look, it's early days because he's only just about to be inaugurated. I think we should note that I'm speaking 2 days before his inauguration. So we really only know his intention. Well, his attempt to revive the National Missile Defense Project comes after President Clinton had toyed with the idea for certainly during his second administration and had in the end decided to put off any decision and leave it to his successor. Had Gore been his successor, it's quite possible we would also have had a decision to go ahead with it rather than not. The Americans do seem to be convinced that this is the only way of tackling rogue elements that might acquire nuclear weapons. They don't see this as an answer to a Russian threat, which they, as of now, don't really see as a significant threat. But they do see a threat from all manner of countries that are either developing or already have nuclear weapons, such as North Korea, Iraq, Iran, possibly. I mean, the CIA has come up with quite a list of countries that they believe are not only developing nuclear weapons, but also have the ability to launch them. And they claim that this is a threat, although it's called the National Missile Defense Shield. George W. Bush, and as far as we can tell, certainly the Secretary for Defense believe that, and his national security advisor believe that this is the only way of establishing any kind of deterrent and certainly a safeguard against nuclear attack by rogue elements. What Colin Powell's position on all of this is, the new Secretary of State, it really isn't yet clear, but I imagine it will become clear. One mustn't forget that Powell is the person, is the general who believes that the United States should never engage in any military enterprise without overwhelming strength, and that they must not risk any loss of life of its military in the process of either defending or attacking any potential aggressor. And just how he assesses the nuclear missile shield project, both in terms of America's ability to develop a foolproof system and of its ability to deter attack, I think we shall see. Of course, quite apart from any political objection to it, which I'll address in a second, there is the whole question of whether such a missile shield can really be developed. All the tests so far have been negative, to put it mildly, and they have certainly not been successful. And it is obvious that a huge amount of money would have to be spent on the development of such a missile shield before it would become clear that it really is an effective weapon. But if the Americans are prepared to invest that kind of money in it, then we shall still have to see whether or not they can achieve their technical objectives. The political issues that are involved in the development of the missile shield appear, as of now, to be huge and to threaten not only America's relationship with Russia and with China, but to some extent also with the NATO alliance. And when it comes to assessing the durability of NATO and its ability to survive and to remain an effective military and political alliance, I think the controversy surrounding the missile shield are far greater than the controversy surrounding the proposals for the European Rapid Reaction Force, because Europe is certainly deeply divided about the political fallout from the development of the nuclear missile shield. In Britain, there is one specific problem, which is whether its Fylingdales should be used as a radar station, and which would imply that Britain is directly involved in the development and in the deployment of the proposed weaponry. And it would also mean that Britain would become party to the violation of the ABM treaty, which would undoubtedly result from the development of this missile shield. And here I think we will see a resurgence of the old Green and Peace movement directed now at Fylingdale, and I think it is a genuine political dilemma for any British government. It is surprising that the leader of the Conservative Party decided to endorse it for the sake of the special relationship between Britain and the United States, without really looking at without taking into consideration any of the political issues involved, both in terms of the strains on domestic politics and also in terms of the inevitable strain on relationships with Russia and with China. Now, it is quite obvious that the Russians really mean it when they say that their opposition is principled and important, and that they're not going to be swayed by American arguments, that this is simply to protect the United States against newcomers on the nuclear scene, and that it certainly isn't designed as a deterrent against Russian attacks, though, you know, it's hard to see where you draw the limit. But the Russians really do see it as an upset in the balance of power which has been established in the post-Cold War period. And it does concern them, and they have always set huge store by the ABM Treaty. The question of amending the ABM Treaty came up already when President Reagan first proposed his Star Wars, had made his Star Wars proposal, and I remember at the time the chairman of the Senate Defense Committee, Senator Nunn, had hearings on this and developed lengthy arguments against anything that might infringe and that might violate the ABM Treaty. That would not be in the U.S. interest. And I think this is obviously a hugely important issue, as is China's attitude. China clearly takes this very seriously. Some people, of course, say that one reason why, some Americans would argue that one reason why it would be important to develop the national missile defense system is because it would force China to spend more on the arms race, and that again you would have the sort of same process that you applied towards the Soviet Union during the Cold War, that by forcing China to put more of its resources into armaments, slow down the economic progress of China and make it less of a competitor on the international trade scene. Well, now, this is a very far-fetched scenario, and I really don't take that very seriously, because on the whole, American business wants China to flourish because it sees China as a market for its goods. It doesn't see China as much more as a market for its goods rather than as a competitor in other markets. But at least it is an argument which is being put forward in support of the defense missile shield, even though this is something that seems so far removed from the arguments which are being used officially. Whether the new administration will go through with it, I think, is less of a moot point than the speed at which it tries to go to develop it, the amount of resources that it will put into it. There are quite a lot of people on this side of the Atlantic who argue that since there is a certain air of inevitability about the project in America, that the Europeans would be wiser to support it rather than to oppose it, because they can't stop it, and all that they will do is to aggravate tensions between Europe and the United States. And it may be that Tony Blair, if he's re-elected, if he remains Prime Minister, will take the view, will accept this view, and will decide that rather than oppose it and rather than try to stand in the way of this project, to go ahead with it, to support the Americans and to allow filing to be used. Now, I have heard at least one senior Republican who is not now in the administration argue that, first of all, the Americans can develop all this without the use of filing Dale. They don't need, it is not absolutely crucial as a radar station to the whole project. And secondly, if it splits up NATO, so what? We are now in the post-Cold War period. NATO is no longer such an important instrument of security policy. And if the Europeans are foolish enough to try and stand in the way of missile defense, okay, if that harms the Atlantic Alliance, so be it. Now, how widespread that view is and to what extent such a view is going to prevail within the administration is far from clear. It will be very interesting to see how the Europeans will react if such sentiments are voiced in private exchanges between the two governments and indeed in public.
Do you think the New World Order is any more stable than what occurred in the Cold War?
I don't think we've got a New World Order yet. I think we're still groping for one. And I think, it was President Bush Sr., the first Bush number one, who kept on talking about the New World Order. But I think all that we saw during his administration was renewed disorder, far more local wars, and indeed we had the Gulf War during his period in office, and we've had the Congo, we've had any number of countries that are far from stable, and we have not yet learned how to deal with the third world. If anything, the gap between the North and the South is deeper than ever, and you cannot talk about a new world order in a world, in an international community which is divided into haves and have-nots. We haven't really resolved the problem of European integration, and particularly integration of the former East European states into Western institutions, whether it's the European Union or NATO or whatever. And I think altogether the world is a very unstable place, and to talk of the new world order, I think, is unreal, unrealistic, and but because it's not as fashionable a concept anymore as it was a few years ago, but because it is still somehow assumed to be somewhere within the sort of catch-all phrase of globalization, we forget to really think what all this means and how we do achieve a better world order. But no, we are very much in a period of transition and impermanence, I think.